to get a hold of a Bible because we're going to be keeping our fingers in it and looking particularly at John and also Luke's account. How many of you have had an opportunity to attempt to take the different accounts that come through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and bring it together on the trial of Christ? It's quite an interesting exercise, an exercise that will well tax your time and your mind in attempting to follow the sequence of what takes place. I was working on this, and I have a privilege of a book in which I got some years ago, which an individual attempted to do this. It's called The Life of Christ in Stereo. Interesting title. But what the person attempted to do, and I think quite successfully, was to take the whole gospel and bring it into a chronological story, bringing in all the different elements. And the story itself of the trial, I read through it last night. It took me 15 minutes to read through it. And so it is quite comprehensive, and sometimes we will read one gospel and be surprised when you compare it with the others just how much is left out because of the particular aim of the writer. So tonight I'm going to not try to do a complete survey of the trial of Christ, but I want to focus in on the topic of the crowd and the crowd and its influence on Pilate. It's interesting, many times we say Pilate, that Jesus was on trial by Pilate, but I think it would be more correct to say that Pilate was on trial, both by the crowd and by Jesus himself. So we want to look at the influence of the crowd. I was thinking of speaking on this topic of the crowd of the story, which I heard. I think it's fictitious, but it's still a good story about a college in the United States. And there were a number of sportsmen, and sportsmen, as everyone knows, are notorious thickies. And I'm a sportsman, so I qualify, which I don't think is true, but anyway. They were told that in order to keep their grades up, I mean, they have to keep their grades up in order to participate in sport. And this one fellow was having some struggles, and so he's talking to some of his friends, and he said, "Say, could you tell me a good course in which I could get into to get a good mark?" And they said, "Oh yeah, we're taking this really easy course. It's a scripture course." And the professor always gives the same exam. So it's easy. You don't even have to go to class. All you have to do the last few days, simply do some work on the question. You go in, pass the exam, top mark. Easy as that. So he says, "Well, that sounds good." So he signed up for the course. And he went the first day and sat there in the front row beaming at the professor and went up and talked to him how much he was going to enjoy the course this quarter. And then they didn't see him again. Of course, the professor only remembered the beaming face. And then it came time for the final exam in the course. Well, now the question that had always been asked by this professor was that they were to discuss the wanderings and the journeying of the Apostle Paul. Easy, you know, you read the book of Acts, and you have a pretty good idea of where Paul wandered and journeyed about. So he had read and got ready, and all the rest of them for the exam the next day, they went in all ready to go and sat down and took out their papers. Some of them just began to write. And then all of a sudden, there began to whisper around the classroom, and they began to look about, and he said, "Look what he's writing up for the question." So they looked up. He changed the question. And the question was now, "Discuss the Lord's Sermon on the Mount." Oh, you know. Some of them just closed their books immediately and turned in their blue books. That's the little exam books they use. And began to walk out of the class after 5-10 minutes. The class was completely cleared, except this one fella. This one guy that had been really struggling, he was over there beavering away, writing and writing. Well, they went out, went down, had a cup of coffee, and moaned a while to one another about the failure of the exam. And so they realized, well, it's been almost 3 hours. So they went back, and there he is, still in there writing away, you know. They thought, what could he be possibly writing on? Amazing. So the professor came by and said, well, it's obvious that you're the only one who has done any preparation on it. I'm going to give you a top mark. You know, obviously I don't need to read your paper. You've done an excellent work on it. And so he beamed and walked out of the class. And his friends met him and said, what in the world were you doing there? I mean, we knew more than you did, but we got you in the course. I mean, what did you write on that topic? Well, he said, what I did was simply say, who am I to criticize the Lord's Sermon on the Mount? I would prefer to write on the journeys and wanderings of the Apostle Paul. And so he did. That's somewhat the way I feel, talking on the crowds. Who am I to speak on the crowds? But crowds are phenomenal things, both good and bad, to see the influence that crowds do have, and the influence that they have for good, and the influences that they have, and many times we've witnessed, for bad. And the way that crowds can be influenced, it was interesting the case in point that Simon brought up in reviewing the book, Rough Edges. How a crowd is influenced by one man, by certain things. Oftentimes, I've gone to a football match, and I took my father-in-law when he came over, and we went to see a match. And after coming out, we were walking down the street only to see about 20, 30 fellas running up the street, chasing a few other fellas. And finally, they caught him. And about that time, I decided, I'm getting out quick, because who knows what they're going to do. Because the influence of a group of people, a loss of responsibility, and the irresponsibility and the lack of rationale that takes place many times within a group and a crowd. The pressures that crowds bring. One only needs to look, for example, to the union situation and see why do the shop stewards enjoy taking a hands vote where everyone can see what everyone else does, because they can bring pressure to bear by certain people getting in among the crowd, possibly and influencing them. And the tremendous pressure for you to stand up for what you really feel is right and put your hand up, which might be in the minority, and to feel the resentment and the shouts of sellout, etc., etc., is tremendous pressure that crowds can bring. And I think Pilate, and he's an interesting person, but he was obviously influenced by the crowds and not by the person, Jesus Christ, the truth, who was right before him. To see the setting of this, I thought it would be good to just look at the lead-up to the trial. You had the religious leaders, which were made up of the scribes, the Pharisees, the high priests, elders, and such. These people we will call the religious leaders. And very early on, they set out their purpose. When Christ's popularity began to grow, as early as Mark 3, you have them say, we are going to put him to death. So they had set in their minds that he was going to be destroyed. Then you have Pilate, this person in the scene who, when you read about him, he's quite a brutal person. Some of the things that he had got up to were quite terrifying. He had obviously got involved and got on the bad side of Herod, and he and Herod had had some bad feelings of enmity between one another due to his action among some Galileans, which was the area in which Herod governed. And there had been some mixing of Galilean blood with sacrifices. One isn't quite sure exactly all what transpired, but there was some bad feelings there. He was stubborn. He was insensitive. he brought some insignia of Rome right into Jerusalem, and within 6 days there was so much pressure on it that he had to remove it back to Caesarea, where he basically had his place in which he governed from. He probably had a very stubborn, harsh disposition. He was rather an obnoxious type of character. And he probably got into his position as a ruler through marriage to an influential person. And he, as sometimes people are who aren't in that level, who rise up to it, they take over that position and misuse it. That was Pilate. Now, it's interesting that in the final story, after the men have been scattered due to the arrest of Jesus, there's very few people that are involved of the disciples. You have Peter and his denials. You have John, who is obviously around, because when you read John, he introduces Peter in to the inner courts because he knows the high priest. And then you have Judas, this character who has betrayed and who is involved with the religious leaders. And then there's Jesus. He, a few hours earlier, has indicated that it is only a short time until he's going to die. He does not go back to Bethany as he had been doing that week, but he stays in Jerusalem. And earlier Judas had gone to the leaders, the Pharisees, the chief priests, these religious leaders, and he had set up a plan to betray Jesus. And he sees that tonight is the time. Now, it's interesting that way early, if you look at, for example, Luke's account, back in chapter 9, it says that Jesus set his face. One translation says he set his face as a flint towards Jerusalem. And his disciples knew exactly what that meant, that he was going to Jerusalem to die. And Thomas comes up and says, "Do you know what they're going to do to you in Jerusalem?" He says, "Yes." "And that they're going to do it probably to us too." He was going to die. And they were fearful of going. But Jesus knew this was the reason why he came. He came to die. Now, the city of Jerusalem at the Passover time probably increased from a population of 50 to about 50,000 to 250,000. So there was a marked increase of people coming in for the Passover festival. The crowd that welcomed Jesus earlier in the week. Sometimes people feel like, well, that was exactly the same crowd that later on turned against him. I think we'd probably see it's not. The trial took place quite early in the morning, probably as early as 6 o'clock in the morning. And by 12 o'clock, Jesus was probably on the cross. So things took place at a very early stage. Now, there were a half a dozen trials that actually took place. There was, first of all, his arrest. He was brought before Annas, and that was a very short type of trial. And then he was sent on to Caiaphas, from Caiaphas and his house. Then later in the morning, he went and was before the Sanhedrin. And then this group, as a body, and a lot of the leaders, took him to Pilate. Now, it's interesting with two of the accounts basically start with bringing Jesus to Pilate. So he was before Pilate. Then Pilate, seeing that he was a Galilean and came under Herod's jurisdiction, he thought, "I'll send him over to Herod and let him deal with it." Herod sends him back, and Pilate finally tries him and sentences him. So that's a little bit about the background. But what I'd like to do for the remaining few minutes together is see the influence of the crowd on Pilate. Pilate on trial. And I'd like to just go through the stages of change in Pilate's attitude. I'm going to go through 7 stages, I think, that come out in Scripture. So I wish you'd put your noses into the book, into John's Gospel, the part that Jonathan read to us this earlier. We'll go back to Luke also, but keep your finger in John's Gospel. I think as Jesus came to trial here, starting in verse 28, you find Pilate probably in quite an indifferent attitude. Here he was, the governor. It was his function that anyone brought to him. He was to hear cases, and particular cases in which a capital offense was committed and the death sentence needed to be passed. That had been taken from the Jews, and the Romans had that privilege. And so obviously the high priests and those religious authorities knew that they had to bring him to Pilate, and that it had to be an offense in which obviously there's a change of offense from one of blasphemy, in which was a religious offense to the Jews, but to obviously the political rulers, the Romans, that wasn't a political offense. It was a religious matter concerned with the Jews and not them. So they had to have a political offense in which Jesus had in some way gone against Rome. Now, as you look at verse 29, 30, and 31, you can see the dislike that the two parties had toward one another, Rome against the Jews. Because Pilate, what accusation do you bring against this man? And they answer, if this man were not an evildoer, we would not have handed him over to you, would we? You know, there's not a kind of a fine exchange between them. You sense that there's dislike among them. And then Pilate said to them, well, take him yourself and judge him by your own laws. So there wasn't a great deal of time between them. They didn't like one another. And it comes out very, very clear. There was a great deal of animosity that obviously Pilate, because of who he was, had created. And Judah was not the easiest place in which to govern. And then you see the fulfillment of Scripture that comes out in verse 32, the little phrase that comes there. Jesus had spoken to show by what death he was to die. And if you go back into John chapter 3 and John chapter 12, he speaks about hanging on a tree. And here his prediction to hang on a cross. Of course, the way the Jews killed people was to stone them. So Jesus was going to have to be tried by the Romans and killed on a cross. Now, from indifference, Pilate then begins to be slightly curious. For what reason? We're not quite sure. Maybe it was out of spite of the Jewish leaders who had brought him. But we see the next point, he moves to a stage of curiosity. And he asks this question, are you the king of the Jews? Are you the king of the Jews? With the emphasis on you, and one could almost look at, are you the king of the Jews? This is what they're saying you are. Almost done in a half-joking, a half-mocking way. I mean, it must have been pretty pathetic sight. Here Jesus had been brought in. He'd been up all night. He had been hit about on the face and knocked about in his body. He probably didn't look too good. And here he is standing there and half-joking, you're their king? You know, almost in a half-joking manner. And he then responds to them. And Jesus says to them, do you say this on your own accord, or did others say it about me? Very interesting. He throws it right back into Pilate's court. And then Pilate responds back, am I a Jew? You know, what are you saying this to me for? Am I a Jew? And there you see the Pilate just kind of disassociating himself in bitterness again from the Jews, knowing very little about the nation. And Jesus talks about his kingdom and that they did not fight because his kingdom was that of another world. And then Pilate comes out with another very interesting question. So you are a king? It's a question mark. And Jesus answers, affirmative, I am. And then he goes on to open up talking about the truth. And it's interesting. Here Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life, stands right before Pilate. And he says, what is the truth? It stands right before him. Well, obviously, this caused Pilate to think a little bit different. His probably half-joking, half-mocking comments. He began to be more curious, a little bit more serious. And I think this takes on to the next stage. He began to be more personally concerned about it. Because after this, he goes out and he says to them, I find no crime in this man. There's nothing there. Now, when you turn back then to Luke's account in chapter 23, it's probably at this stage in which the religious leaders stand up and begin to accuse him more and more. They say, well, he stirred up all kinds of trouble up in Galilee and now has come to Jerusalem. And he had just cleared the temple a few days earlier and there had been problems. And so they were bringing accusations against Jesus. And then all of a sudden, insensitive as he was, Pilate said, you mean he's a Galilean? He wasn't even aware that he was a Galilean. Well, if that's the case, then I have a way in which I'll be able to get out. I'll send him to Herod. Off he goes to Herod Antipas. And then you have the story in which John does not even include the relationship there of Herod and his response to Jesus. Now, Herod wanted him to come and do some miraculous signs. He'd heard about Jesus, but had not met him and not seen him. So he wanted to be entertained. That's maybe why John didn't even include it, because he finally, Jesus doesn't comply with his wants. He sends him back to Herod again. And so as he comes back, there's obviously, you might say that Pilate is caught in a very touchy situation. Here Herod has said, no, it's back to Pilate again, and Pilate has to pick up the responsibility of trying him. He had avoided or tried to avoid that responsibility. And so it comes before him that he is supposed to give a verdict. And that verdict the Jews wanted was to be death. The charge they brought to him hadn't stood up to Pilate. It hadn't stood up to Herod. And so it's faced here. Here he is, Pilate the man, who stands for Rome, who is supposed to stand for truth, who is supposed to stand for justice, bending under the influence of these religious leaders. Now, it's very difficult to say when the crowds entered in. There was a great coming and going of Pilate. There's probably as many as 8 times Pilate went out to them, went back in, went back out, went back in, went back out. You can begin to see how Pilate had got caught up in this and was greatly influenced by this man Jesus and these Jews and the responses and the questions and the things they were putting before him. Now, you have to put all the accounts together to come up with that number. And so when you read one account, you begin to see that, well, there's not 8 times he goes in and out in John, for example. But when you begin to put them all together, you can see this great tension that was about him. He was more and more personally concerned about it. Then I think you come to what I call the turning point. He was indifferent. He became curious. Then he became very personally involved. And here's the turning point. He should have said, I, as the Roman authority, dismiss him. There is no charge against him. But you begin to see that he, at that time, turns and is influenced very strongly by the crowds. He realizes that Passover, every Passover, there's one criminal that's given an amnesty. And so he says, this is my way out. I will simply release Jesus. They think he's guilty. I'll release him. But there was Barabbas who was also there, and they cried out. Now look at verse 40 of chapter 18 of John. It says, they cried out again. Now, if you read back up, there's no other time in which the crowd cried out. And that's why I said the crowd obviously was involved with it. Maybe John didn't write it down, but the crowd was very much involved, continuously putting pressure upon Pilate. They said, "Not this man, we want Barabbas." Now, I find this very interesting because here you have Barabbas, who was a robber, a murderer. In one of the accounts, he says he was involved with an insurrection. He was a criminal, a man who had rebelled against authority. He was guilty. Here's Jesus, who is innocent. It ends up that I don't know how many times Pilate indicates that he is innocent. It's almost a small miniature picture of the world. Barabbas representing the world, its rebellion against its rightful creator, going its own way. And here Jesus, innocent. Jesus comes, the innocent one, who takes the place of Barabbas, the guilty one. It's a beautiful picture because that's exactly what Jesus has done, has come to take the place of the guilty, us, he, the innocent. So it's a beautiful little picture of the two. Jesus, the King, comes innocently to die on a cross. So you see at this point, principle gave way. The principle of truth, the principle of justice gave way to Pilate. He succumbed to this. Some years ago, when U.S. Senator Hatfield, who I'm acquainted with through some things years ago that we did when I was in university, was saying that when he was governor of the state of Oregon, he's now a U.S. senator and is, I think he's chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and a tremendous Christian man, has had a great influence on Chuck Colson. In fact, in Chuck Colson's books, every once in a while, Colson mentions about going out to Hatfield's home on the West Coast and spending some time out in the seashore, where his home is. And Mark Hatfield was telling the story that they had a governor's convention, and they have this every year when the governors of the 50 states come together. And many times there's various propositions placed before them to vote on. And some of these would be giving the states support to the federal government and their policies, or not giving their support. And it was during the Vietnam War situation. And at that time, there was the federal government were pouring man and machinery into Vietnam. Now, the question was, what was the stated policy of the government? And this was a question. Governor Hatfield and some of the other governors talked about the issue. They said, well, what is the federal government's foreign policy? And what is their policy in Vietnam? No one could come up with it. So when they were asked to vote on this on the floor the next day, some of the men had indicated that they were going to stand with Hatfield and question and raise the question of the foreign policy. So when it came around to him to vote either in favor or opposed to it, he asked the question, what is the stated foreign policy of the government? And the chairman said, well, I'm not prepared at this time to give a statement on that. So he says, well, could you give me the stated foreign policy towards Vietnam? He says, well, I'm not prepared at this time to give a statement on that. So Governor Hatfield said, well, then you're asking me to pledge my support for a policy in which you're not really willing to define very clearly, and the support of the state in which I come from. He said, I cannot give my vote to that on principle. Now, it was interesting, the roll call went around, all other 49 states voted for the policy and the amendment to support the government in their foreign policy, except Hatfield. That's kind of a lonely position to be in the crowd. And afterwards, some of these men came up to him and he said, where were you? I thought you were going to be with me on this. And the comment, and I still hear him say it, the comment was, well, we felt since it was an election year, it was politically expedient that we go along with the government. In other words, we sold principle down the line in order to win votes. And this is oftentimes the pressure that the crowd can bring upon us. The pressure of it's expedient. We don't want to rock the boat. We want to look like we're in line and in course. And Pilate saw the situation, the crowd, the pressure and all, and he bent. Expediency over principle. Now then from there, it's very quick. As soon as the rot set in there, it happened very quickly. He began to hesitate. Barabbas is called for. It says in Mark 15 that they stirred the crowd. And it was the same accusation that the religious leaders were using against Jesus before Pilate. It's the same word, stirred. He was stirring them up. They stirred the crowd up, shouting, crying out for Barabbas and to crucify Jesus. Well, in his hesitation, it's interesting because you see, starting with chapter 19, he wants to release him, but he doesn't. He says, what I'll do, I'll compromise. We'll go halfway. We'll punish him, and when he comes out, then they will be satisfied, and that'll be it. And that's what you see happen. He comes and he punishes him. Now, scourging wasn't a light punishment, as many of you know. They had leather tongs, little chips of metal in it, and when a person was tied up and their back was beaten with these tongs, it would rip away the flesh. It was not a pretty picture. In fact, it could be fatal. So you begin to see the horrific amount of punishment that was given to him. And then he thought, when I bring him out and they see the state is in, they'll say, that's enough. You know, we've got our pound of flesh. That's enough. But no, as soon as they came out, they wanted more. He says, here's your man, what's left of him. And they said, crucify him in verse 6. And Pilate said, well, then take him yourself and crucify him. I find no crime in him. Again, he finds no crime in him. So hesitation, I think, then moves on to fear. Look what I've done, and they still want to kill him. Fear sets in after this compromise, and Pilate actually abdicates responsibility. The crowd robs him of responsibility. As the Roman governor, he says, you take him. You do it. I abdicate the responsibility. Then look at verse 9. Interesting little verse 8. When Pilate heard these, and the words were that according to our law, he claims himself, makes him out to be the Son of God. And then Pilate, the comment, he says, when he heard these words, he was even frightened all the more. He was fearful, and now he was terrified. Who is this man? And he then asks Jesus these questions. Where are you from? Won't you speak? Then this is in a sense really interesting. He says, I have the power to release you. What a laugh. I have the power to release you. Did he? He had succumbed. The power was in the hands of the people. They were running him. He wasn't making decisions anymore. He had no power to release him. Power to crucify you. And Jesus simply said, you have no power over me. It's a beautiful picture. Jesus was quietly, subtly, simply saying, I am superior to you. Here he is on trial, but really it's Pilate who's on trial. And then it moves into, I would think, from fear to arrogance. And I think in verse 10 you say, you will not speak for me, or you will not speak to me. The word to there is a very strong word, indicating you're not going to speak to me. You know who I am. I have the power over you. Arrogant. And I find that fear and arrogance oftentimes are very close together. A person many times who's fearful will assert themselves in very arrogant ways. And that's exactly what Pilate did here. Here he is, a pitiful, powerless man, asserting himself. And if you look at Matthew's account in 27:24, he could see that a riot was about ready to take place among these people. The crowd had so built themselves up. He had no power. He was a very pitiful figure. Defeat was there. And then I think from defeat, you see bitterness is the final thing that sets in. Look at verse 13. Well, start with verse 12. Upon this, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend." That terrified him, I would say. Because if Caesar was to hear that I had not carried out these things properly, I would lose my job. And so fear set in. And then he goes on, and it's interesting what you see in 14. Now, it was the day of preparation, the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, "Here is your king." Mocking statement, "your king." And they cry out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said, "Shall I crucify," in a mocking way, "your king?" And you can almost tell that it had to be a mocking way because the response of the chief priests, "We have no king but Caesar." Here they had been looking for years of a Messiah who would come and rid them of the Romans. And they were looking forward to a Messiah who would get rid of these earthly rulers. Here Jesus comes as that man. And what do? They take and kill him and reject him. And what do? They turn right around and they say, "We have only one king." The one they hate shows oftentimes the lack of reasoning power within a crowd. How a crowd lacks reason. Only for their own good do they seek out and they compromise. It's an amazing picture. This sarcasm that you see in Pilate is his last bitter way of trying to get back at the Jews. And then look at verse 21 and 22. The last thing he does out of his hatred and bitterness reflects his character perfectly. And the chief priests of the Jews then said to Pilate, "Do not write the King of the Jews." But this man said, "I am the King of the Jews." And Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." He says, "Take it. I'm tired of you." And they put that on it. He did it to spite the Jews. So you see a man who, goodness knows what happened. You know, he'd been confronted with the truth, Jesus Christ. And the crowd bent him in principle and all. And he fell away. And denied and sent Jesus to his death. It's kind of the crowd versus the truth. The crowd versus the truth. And I think many times this is the pattern that we see. That same pattern. Many times people will be indifferent and they become curious to the gospel. And then personally, intensely interested in who this person Jesus Christ is. The truth stands right before them. And they should respond to it. But if they reject it, that rejection then turns into fear, to arrogance, and many times to bitterness. And I think we need to look at ourselves as Christians and see the influence that the crowd has on us. Who leads us? Who influences? Are you listening to men or are you listening to God? Are you listening to the truth? Are you listening to those things in which honor God, that put God's desires first? Are you listening to those things in which promote holiness of living? Are you listening to things that promote God's kingdom by the spread of His gospel? Do you promote those things in which, and listen to those people, which are interested in service instead of setting themselves up in a position of authority? It's tremendous to see that it's the crowd who sways us, but it's the truth of Jesus Christ that keeps us on track. Pilate looked and listened to the crowd when the truth, Jesus Christ, was standing square in front of him. It's a horrific picture And Jesus Christ stands in front of us and he says, listen to me and not the crowd. Shall we pray? Father, as we come into this week of Passion, in which we remember your Son's trial, his suffering, his death, his burial, and his glorious resurrection, I pray that we would take the lesson in which Pilate did not see and did not learn, and that we would learn from him that as we see the truth and the direction and the way we should go, may we weigh it by you and your Son and the truth that has been revealed to us, and not be influenced one way or the other by the crowd, by the people we run with. May we not conform to them, but may we stand and be counted among those that even might suffer for the sake of the gospel. Give us courage and strength by the indwelling Spirit that you place within us. May we dwell and draw upon him and his resources daily, moment by moment, in order that your kingdom might be spread until you come again. In Jesus' name, amen. Believes or trusts all things, he says this. It means that love is not basically suspicious. It takes the kindest view of others in every circumstance, as long as it possibly can. It takes the kindest view in every circumstance as long as it possibly can. Husbands, wives, girlfriends, boyfriends, you know, to the wife, to the husband, where have you been? Why are you so late? What have you been getting up to? You know, suspicious. Husband to a wife, where's all the money gone? My wife comes in and says, dear, can I borrow some more money? And I say, well, I just gave you 10 pounds yesterday. Where did it all go? And after a while, she kind of comes in and she doesn't ask for money anymore. She begins to say, now I need to get this, this, and this. I need, and she gives me the list of what she's going to spend. You know, who's being suspicious? I am. And I think we need to realize that suspicion and a lack of trust destroys relationships. It always hopes. We always expect the best of someone. That's what it means. It always hopes the best. You know, when everything else, when everybody else gives up, remember, Jesus never gives up on us, does he? We can fall so bad, so low, so far, but he's always there saying, come unto me. Now, as Christians, we need to begin to reflect that type of love towards one another within our marriages and relationships, between our boyfriend, girlfriend, flat situations. And people will begin to say there's a difference there because we always hope the best for the other person. And we expect nothing but good things, even though the appearance might be against them. Even though in appearance it seems to be bad, we still hope the best for them. See, God, even though we run off the rails at times, and sometimes way off the rails, God still says, I have great hopes in you. I have an incurable confidence that I can work a good work in your life. And we have to have that same ability and love towards people that God can work in their lives. He has the ability to do so, to change us. That type of love gives a great amount of creativity to our marriages, to any type of relationship that's a permanent relationship. It creates an environment where there's growth and development can take place. And I think we always, as I said before, Jesus never gives up on us. His best, he always thinks of our best. And then finally, love perseveres. It endures. It overcomes all things. It is overcoming all difficulties. It cannot be conquered. There's never a day when we say, love endeth. It always has a future. Now, I think as we look at these things, there's two camps that we probably fall into. We might have the attitude, well, I'm going to go out today and I'm going to try to love like this. And you'll probably get home and meet someone and a circumstance will come up and you'll show the most ugly side of your character. We can try by our own flesh and our own flesh will always fail us. But we can say, this is what God desires, the qualities within my life. And I want to let Him to begin to work those things in me and out through me. See, God just simply wants us to turn our lives over and say, I'm willing for you to change me and to make me that type of person. And it's not a passive thing. It's seeing what He demands and what He wants and saying, God, do it through me. There's others probably maybe that have not even come to the point of acknowledging Christ as the Lord of one's life and have not received that Spirit of love. And as we close in prayer, I pray that both those that do not know Christ and those of us who do would say, God, come in a new, fresh way. In your Spirit, begin to break the hardened heart of mine. Begin to work through me these characteristics that I might have a foundation.